Please pray with me. O Heavenly Father.
O Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Blessed Master.
Blessed Master.
Dearest Mother.
Dearest Mother.
Beloved David.
Beloved David.
Saints and sages of all religions.
Saints and sages of all religions.
I bow to all of you.
I bow to all of you.
Free my life from all obstacles.
Free my life from all obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Reigning on the throne of my conscience.
Oh. Peace.
Peace.
Bliss.
Bliss.
Amen. Do a short meditation now for few minutes. Okay, we'll pick up the reading from page 29, Kate, if you would, please.
Kate, you have to unmute again.
So, Larry read a little bit of this last week, but I think we'll just start where she's just finished the mother's just talked about the first experience. And so we'll start at the bottom, page 28 there. But this was only the first experience. There were two more to go because that was the first day of the descension into hell, you see. The second one is when you are released from this astral body, and the third one is when you are released from the idea or the causal body. Then, if it is God's will, the consciousness returns to the body, and you function as a Christed one, a glorious one of God. Now, this experience was tremendous, and the pain across this heart region was so immense that I can't begin to tell you. The fungus built up in my mouth. It seemed as though all of my teeth were crooked and they felt like mountains and had assumed size far beyond their normal size. I was in terrific pain through all of this. I remember that one vision came, and it was like I heard St. Francis driving wolves in front of me. I thought, how tremendous, even that he is in this scene too. So I prayed to him to pray to God for me, and it seemed as though he went by, then part of this was released. Part of the pain was gone and part of the pressure from my mouth. Gradually, I came back to consciousness, but not fully, and the pain was so great that I sent for Papa. This was at 6 o'clock in the morning. I remember kneeling on the bed facing him, and I said, Papa, you must help me. You must take some of this from me. What can he do? He says. I said, I don't know, but you must. I cannot bear it and live. I deliberately reached over and took his hand and placed it on my chest, and I gave him part of what I had. The release came, but not completely. I was still in such terrible pain, it was unbelievable. There were two boys with him. He was going down to look at the house of a worker, and he just got a little way outside, and he fell on the ground. He had to be picked up and carried to bed, and he remained in bed 3 days with the pain I had given him. And still I had it. Still I had it. But then after a certain time, because I had been through the death experience, then the state of rigor mortis or paralysis set in. And so I developed polyneuritis, which was a total paralysis of the whole body. I couldn't speak. And when I started first to use my limbs again, I had to have somebody on either side of me. They tried to keep me in my room, and I was determined that I was going to go and attend the Bhajan. One soldier who had been critical of me before and all of my efforts, because I was an American, finally, seeing the tremendous effort I was putting forth to go and sit at the feet of the saint in spite of my condition, came up and apologized to me and told me that I was more courageous than any woman he had ever known in his life. And so this spread about this woman from America going through all these experiences. Papa would bring them in, any number that would fit into the room, and have them look at me and say, this is what it means to destroy an ego. So there are many, many witnesses to the truth which I tell you. They were there. They saw. They heard. Swami Satchidananda told me that in anything I wrote, he would be glad to write a testimonial and testify to the truth of which I teach. I had never told him of all the experiences that I had gone through. Somehow I'd not been directed to before. But this last time, and we have a footnote, Mother was referring to her trip to India in 1977. This last time I said to him, I've never told you all about what I went through inside. You saw the outer manifestation of it, but you didn't know what it all meant. So I proceeded to describe to him the way of the cross and the Christ as I had experienced it and relate it to the Christian scriptures. He was thrilled beyond words, and he said, Mother, you must write. Now, as soon as you go home, you sit down and you start writing this book. The world must have the truth. Remember this, because this is important. Many people become frightened when you would describe something like this to them, and they would think, I don't want any part of it. The reason that I have had to go through this, I was told by God himself, is so that I might be able to explain what the true meaning of the scriptures is as related to man himself. Therefore mine was perhaps violent and very severe in many ways, so that it would be impressed upon my mind in a way that I could never forget it and that I would describe it. But there are many who go the way of the cross within themselves, and this is not nearly as violent. The way is the same. There's only one path that leads to God. Remember, the path to hell is wide and paved with gold, but the path to God is very narrow. This is the straight and narrow way, which is the way of the spine. This is the baptism of blood. This is what it means to be washed in the blood of the Savior inside of yourself. That Savior is within every man. And it's a very real experience, the most real experience I've ever had in my life. This is not something I was imagining. I had never heard of it in this way in all of my life. I had never read it. It was God himself who, because of my total and complete surrender and because I had been given the vision of who I was and what I had to do, had lifted me up and put me through this experience so that I'd be able to tell all who came after me the living truth of what the crucifixion means and what it means to be baptized and washed in the blood of the Christ. And then we have a little postscript. Ram Dass crucified the ego in order that the divine might live. His love for me knew no bounds because he had no thought, no care for my body, for my mind in one way. It was only that he wanted my soul to live, to become purified, to be one with God. Still, while I underwent that experience, I saw the greatest evidence of loving kindness, of divine love and service that I had ever seen, that any man could see anywhere because of all the needs that he could provide for both Father and myself, physically, were taken care of with the greatest of love. I always remember the day that I was finally able to go back into the Bhajan room after I had been confined to my room for almost 4.5 months, unable to leave it. I had to be carried there. I was seated alongside of him, and he looked at me with the sweetest smile on his face, one of infinite sweetness and love. He said, "Ram Dass is so very happy to see you again." So, and then we had a little quote here from a letter from to Mother from Swamiji in 1980. "Out of that, because you gave yourself to God, now you are lifted up and you are able to teach people the truth and take them to God." So that's the end of that chapter.
Very nice, thank you. Well, I'd like to stay on the theme that I think is important, and we do want to discuss what was just read too, but it's all of a piece. And I love that summation at the end there, Kate. But I have some quotes about the time that Jesus was living in, and about the countervailing religious beliefs and the different clearly an explanation for what Mother claimed that the Bible, this biblical story of Jesus, is not historical. It is allegorical. And this book I've told you about is called The Jesus Mysteries. Tim Freak is the author's name. He has some interesting quotes, and I just want to read you this. And this is important context to support what Mother's been saying. What we're learning here is about how the Bible describes what goes on in the body in order to gain realization. The things that Mother brings forward is the Eastern connections with the 12 chakras and the six chakras, the 12 apostles, and the chakras being related to that. Some of the numerology of the Hindu teachings, and the certainly the notion of the Kundalini and the kinds of things that we have some certainty. We know Saint Francis went through a lot of these things. But just, these are just a few things. I'll read them, and I think they're important. And I'm going to put this up on the website, on the minister's website, that we're, or the, there's classes, laid out, that will be, this will be called the Mystical Crucifixion class. And class number one is up there now. And I'll include this, PDF of this, and we'll add more to it as I go through the book. But these are very, very important things. This is from the book. We have become convinced. This is the author. There's actually two authors, so he's saying we because of the two, the person is helping him. We have become convinced that the story of Jesus is not the biography of an historical Messiah, but a myth based on perennial pagan stories. Christianity was not a new and unique revelation, but actually a Jewish adaptation of the ancient pagan mysteries, mystery religion. As long ago as the Renaissance, mystics, and this, so that's one quote, this is another from another part of the book. As long ago as the Renaissance, mystics and scholars saw the origins of Christianity in the ancient Egyptian religion. In another place, the philosophers of the ancient world were the spiritual masters of the inner mysteries. They were mystics and miracle workers, more comparable to Hindu gurus than dusty academics. At the heart of the mysteries were myths concerning a dying and resurrecting God-man who was known by many different names. In Egypt, he was Osiris. In Greece, Dionysus. In Asia Minor, Attis. In Syria, Adonis. In Italy, Bacchus. In Persia, Mithras. Fundamentally, all these God-men are the same mythical being. From the 5th century before Christ, philosophers such as Xenophanes and Empedocles had ridiculed taking the stories of the gods and goddesses literally. They viewed them as allegories of human spiritual experience. So this goes way back. The mysteries are completely absorbed in this. And then, event by event, we found we were able to construct Jesus' supposed biography from mythic motifs previously relating to Osiris Dionysus. And then they look into the Gnostics, which David and I both studied the Gnostics in school, and we've read a lot about them over the years. And it's clear that the Gnostics reflected the movement of the higher teachings. And that they had a major, one branch of the Gnostics probably, or the Jewish Gnostics became the, and that was the branch that became the Christian religion. It was just one thread of this manifold, large group of teachings and beliefs. What particularly struck us was that the Gnostics were not concerned with the historical Jesus. They viewed the Jesus story in the same way that the pagan philosophers viewed the myths of Osiris Dionysus, as an allegory which encoded secret mystical teachings. We knew that most ancient Mediterranean cultures had adopted the ancient mysteries, adapting them to their own national tastes and creating their own version of the myth of the dying and resurrecting God-man. In another place, perhaps some of the Jews had likewise adopted the pagan mysteries and created their own version of the mysteries, which we now know as Gnosticism. So that was the movement. Gnostics are what we see moving forward in history. This particular group is a large number of people believing in these mysteries. And I don't have the quote in front of me right now. But the one thing he does say is that it appears that a great flowering happened when these mysteries, the higher teachings, were brought to and played out in a system of initiation. And secrecy with the mysteries, that these brought into being some of the greatest thinking and the greatest thoughts. They had a quickening effect on the society that they were brought into. And it all happened during the Kali Yuga. So the Kali Yuga needed something more concrete. We get out of it the Jesus story, which is a wonderful story. And Mother has shown us what's going on in this teaching. How it reflects to what the attainment of God realization, what's involved in that. And of course, in later times, we'll have Mother talk about the chakras and how Kundalini works. But, I think this is so important to bring this connection of the allegorical part of the story and why Mother is, you know, somewhat unique in teaching that she sees the crucifixion in the Christian world as being identical to or being the same thing as the Kundalini in the Eastern world. And I think that's a tremendously important thing. And I think also the chakras are very important. Because if, you know, those of us who have experienced these chakras in our body, these are undeniable experiences. They are very powerful, and they are very much located in the physical body and in the astral body. And you can feel them. You can identify energy flowing through them, and you can feel the stretching of your consciousness as the energy flows through these, and as you break down each of the Gordian knots, so to speak, at each of the centers. When we're brought into this body, we start from the root ball in the head, and we're born. We take our first breath, and we are then, the soul is locked into the body, Mother taught us. And then as we grow, we slowly learn to run, to operate our limbs, our arms, our legs. All the automatic system is going fine. We're digesting food and eating and having no trouble with the automatic things, the heartbeats, all of that. But slowly as the soul explores the body and comes down through the tree of life of the body, then more and more capabilities develops, and the child grows into an adult. When it comes to the very bottom of the chakras, at the base chakra, and then the child goes through puberty and comes in. This is why it's so important. It's different stages that all societies have recognized. The Catholics, interestingly, have first communion at 7 years old, and that is a key thing. I believe there's something to do with the will and the ability to use the brain in abstractions, be able to handle abstract thoughts. And then you don't really become a full adult until you go through the puberty, and you are then fully involved in the reproductive aspect of this body. It's a very important part of the body. And then it is necessary, of course, all of that's part of the story of going, of the Kundalini and the raising of the Kundalini to return back to the land of milk and honey in the skull, the pituitary and the pineal gland. But okay, so anybody has any comments or questions we can talk about? That's just all background, and I'm going to continue to repeat it. I think it's important. But that's my thing, and I think the mother's teachings here are important that we stay on topic on that. And so this was a very difficult time for Mother. She tries to explain how much pain she was in. I think that's such a dramatic thing that she mentions of she's talking to Papa, that, taking Papa's hand and placing it on her chest is an outrageous act. But she was in such desperate straits. And it was going on for so long.
Larry, can you talk a little more about how the parallels between the crucifixion and the Bible story and the Jesus story and the Kundalini?
Well, of course, the Kundalini coming through the heart center is where the first crucifixion takes place. And that is literally you're on a cross, and that's a cross-like experience. So the Kundalini experience is as though the energy is pushing up through the heart center. It's encountering resistance, and you have tremendous heat. What's not mentioned in the Christian story is enough discussion about what kind of heat and fire is going through the body. There is a baptism of fire discussed, but the one thing the Hindus do bring us, the Indians do bring us, is the story of the heat of the Kundalini. And this is the resultant effect. This is the effect of the Kundalini trying to get through these centers, which are closed, and they have to be broken. And it's very painful to go through, or very disorienting. It has several, and it manifests differently in each person. So that's the connection, is the kundalini is this energy that comes from goes through the spine, goes up the spine from the base chakra, and then proceeds upwards into, in each chakra there's an experience associated with it. Mother said there's a sound that comes from each chakra, and I think there's a smell. I think
taste
she mentioned
and a smell.
Taste and a smell. Thank you. Yeah.
Isn't Larry the revelations? Doesn't that address quite a bit of the kundalini and that process?
Well, yeah, I think Mother does talk about that. Seems to be of interest to her, but. Nothing's coming to me right now.
Yeah.
I'm focused mostly on the Christ, the circuits really that, you know, that, is, being described in the Bible. The revelation is, Mother does talk about the beast and the dragon and putting the beast tries to put the dragon back on the throne or vice versa. I forget.
There's a lot of heat and fire and flames in Revelation.
Yeah.
But I know
Kate would remember better.
Yeah.
Kate might remember better what parts, for that's part of the later part of the book, of course. We can't hear you, Kate. We can't hear you.
She's fixing it.
I said later in the book we will have more of that. My mother talks more about Revelation, so.
Geraldine, did that explain?
Maybe discuss it in more that time.
Geraldine, did that explain things enough, at least to start understanding?
So it sounds like this kundalini energy is sort of a spiritual process or a purification energy that's going up through the different chakras. And is it usually a process that takes time, it goes through the different chakras at different times, or it's different for everyone, I imagine, eh?
Mm-hmm. And it takes lifetimes sometimes, some parts of it. Mm-hmm. The most subtle one is the, very subtle one is the fifth center, and then the most subtle is the sixth center. You're really at sea there. So, but the main thing is that the Bible story that Mother's teachings are associated with is to show how this process starts, how the kundalini is first stimulated into going now in the story of Jesus, it's his descent into Egypt, which represents the base chakra. And then once the Herod dies, which Mother says is the sexual energy or the sexual desire goes finally. And that that diversion of energy is gone. And so once Herod is gone, then the soul is released from the base chakra. So it's interesting that the seed is able to go downward, very small, and we can think of this as, in plants, we have a lot of evidence of the seed, but the Christ seed is born in Bethlehem, so there's something that we know, there's fluids, and there's the Christ seed coming from the upper part of the brain, you know, into the pineal and pituitary gland. They are the Joseph and Mary. They go along, they bring the seed down to the Bethlehem, which is in the stomach. And then it proceeds during that time to protect the seed after the Christ is born, the Christ seed. Then you're really starting to have experiences, by the way, at that time. You are having flashes, you feel the birth of the child, of the baby Jesus. That whole notion, sometimes especially for women, manifests very strongly. And then the descent, then to hide the child, they take him to Egypt to get him down below. So Herod can't destroy it. He destroys many others, but he doesn't destroy the Christ seed.
Well, I should point out perhaps, and maybe we discussed it a little bit in the introduction or in the editor's note, is that the process is an entirely linear process. So we just made the decision as we put the book together to, you know, first have Mother meeting how she met her master, and then went to Papa, and then her main experience that she had in India, we put that into the third chapter too, because the whole focus of the book was that. And then we started with the Christ seed, even though that's not the beginning of the whole spiritual process, because we decided to follow the Jesus life, you know, Jesus's life of the birth and the, you know, the manger in Bethlehem and, you know, in Egypt, and then go through eventually getting to the, you know, the baptism and then the crucifixion and then the ascension. But so that was the decision of how to lay the book out. It isn't exactly the way the spiritual process happens.
And mother never explained it linearly either, so we never got it from her in any of us. Charmel, am I right to this? Mothers would talk about different parts of it at different times.
Mm-hmm. Which was the challenge, of course, putting the book together. And right. But I, you know, we are first putting it together. Larry said, you know, let's not have it be a textbook. And this is mother's experience, and that should be almost front and center. So that's why we put it very early on in the book. That the experience in India.
And it's not, Geraldine, so the idea when they're saying it's not a linear experience, you can cycle back through each piece before you've gotten all the way through that cycle of astral, physical astral or causal. Crucifixion.
The way that Mother described it too, I've always often wondered if we don't go through, say, we don't even as a soul go through it in a linear fashion. We have to attain each state before we go to the next one. But we might in a lifetime revisit a difficult, circuit through the heart center again and go through it again. But it won't be as devastating. And then if you're working on the fifth center, say in this lifetime, but it comes up as a spine, as the Kundalini energy comes up the spine in this lifetime, you still have repercussions that are similar to the fourth chakra. That's always, Mother never said that explicitly, but that's always seemed reasonable because of the way she talked about it. Talk about other lifetimes, people going through different things at different lifetimes and coming into this lifetime and not manifesting much of it in this lifetime at all. So.
And she wanted us to know all of this so we would have some kind of guide as we go through it, eh?
Not to guide us through it, but for us to know that when we experience these things, that it's truths. So it's not, this is not a how-to.
Right.
This is a confirmation.
Yeah.
Right. I think you're really right to say it's not a how-to, but it is also something that you can revisit and understand and bring the upper brain, the discriminating brain, into the understanding of it. The thing that, remember, Master came here for was to bring the higher teachings to the Christian world. And so the Christians have missed the understanding of what is in store for us as human beings and what the human life is for. So we need guideposts. We need people to know this to go forward into time. And this is what Mother's brought to teach the world, is to bring these higher teachings to the West and show the connection to the Christian world. But I am very intrigued with this book's statement that so many of the countries changed after these mystery religions were brought in. They gave a place for people to celebrate and to have a higher understanding of what the body is involved in and what this physical world is about while we're here, and what really, because this is clearer in the higher ages, the higher yugas. It's not clear now, and we do need something to a map of some sense of what to expect and how to explain things for sure. But I do agree too that you cannot. What you're implying there is that it's not a how-to book, because it literally is something God does through you. And it really requires a guru, it requires a teacher, and it really was stimulated by that. And so once it starts, you really just, the whole notion of doing it through linearly, it doesn't matter to you because you're dealing with each thing in such a fierce fashion. Sometimes anyway, some people go through it very easily, some parts of it very easily. But you're dealing with these things and they're wholly absorbing you, and it just doesn't matter really.
I think the other thing, I think all of us devotees have, well, I've talked to other devotees about, is that Mother will say these things and you hear them repeatedly. But then when you're actually going through an experience, those words come back to you and you understand it in a whole new way. Mm-hmm. And it really helps you at that point. Whereas before it may have been an intellectual concept, or it may have just gone over your head entirely. But then, you know, those words come back, which is what, of course.
I love David's story. he talks about some of his disciples saying, well, why didn't you explain this to me? He's thinking, I did explain. You just didn't believe it at the time. Oh, when you said that this happens in such a way, I didn't know you really meant that it's going to happen in that way.
That's exactly what came to me too.
Yeah.
You meant you really, really.
There was something for me in Mother's in this book. I acknowledge that you said it is not a how-to, but there's something that for me was so infinitely practical
and comforting.
And it's on page 24. But she says you go through in effect, it's a definite state of schizophrenia. The only difference is that...
Go ahead and read that whole paragraph, yeah, please.
Okay. I did many, many strange things because, you see, the state that you go through, in effect, is a definite state of schizophrenia. Mm. The only difference is that if it is a spiritual experience, you come out of it completely balanced, completely sane, and completely God-realized. But the one who is affected this way by a mental disease loses all sense of identity. This is the way you differentiate between the two. And really, you would think you were going crazy. You really would think you should be on medication. You should be seeing a therapist. There's something not right with you when you're going through these experiences. And the difference is it's so intense, but then because you have Mother's teachings, then you say, okay, Mother went through this. Mm-hmm. Mother went through this, so I feel crazy, but when it's finished and God says, okay, that's finished, then you feel completely sane. And
right. I mean, this is the thing. Yeah, we can. The proof is in that the state that you attain for sure. The problem can be that a person who is schizophrenic in this lifetime could easily be going through it, but it's going to take a lifetime to get through it, perhaps too. So we have to have some sympathy for those who go through these. It's a very schizophrenia seems to be a very disorienting. And she said, even the self. What, read that last bit that after the fact. That the personality or the ego structure is gone.
Oh, yeah. She says the one who is affected this way by a mental disease loses all sense
of identity. Isn't that interesting? Because this is what we're all dealing with here, is to gain knowledge of our true identity, and it disassembles the personality. That's so interesting.
But without Mother expressly saying that, I think a lot of, I mean, we're all very fortunate that we have Mother to tell us that, because otherwise it would be really easy to lose yourself in those experiences.
Right. And, you know, with Mother, she said she was so grateful that she was with Papa because he protected her. They did have psychiatrists come down from Mangalore, or psychologists and people trying to, you know, see if they could help. But they would never be allowed to give her, you know, Thorazine or some of these really, really strong drugs that they treat people with Papa being right there. He knew what was going on, and he doesn't. The other thing that's very interesting about Papa is Swamiji said he never explained anything to them. These poor people at the ashram just lived with this woman who was, you know, Mother was difficult to be around during this very difficult times. So at different times. I mean, we interviewed Lingapa and Kunyambu, and they talked about how Mother would, especially Lingapa, said she would yell for Lingapa to help her to come. Interesting. But those are difficult things, but Papa never explained them to. That's so, so mysterious. But she was completely protected being in that small, remote area of the world.
You know, what's interesting, Larry, is that you can read so many spiritual scriptures by so many great saints, and nobody talks about this.
Yeah, yeah.
We're very unique. I mean,
yeah, you're right.
You're blessed to have this explanation. And the, when you read great saints, you know, they say, keep your mind on God, keep focused on God.
Right.
You know, love
God. It's the only thing that gets you through, really, isn't it?
Well, the thing is that advice is complete because, people sometimes they say, well, if you're going through this spiritual experience and nobody knew what was going on, you know, would you end up in a mental institution or whatever? And I believe that God takes care of us, whether it be in the form of Papa or in the form of Master or in the form of David or in the form of Mother coming to you. God takes care of us. We keep our minds on God and we go through these experiences and we'll be taken care of. But and Mother admonishes us. She says, keep your mind on God no matter what. And if you've ever had an experience where you don't know what's happening to you, and it's very powerful, I know for myself, all I can do is keep my mind on God. That's all. You know, and just hang on to that with everything. And I believe if we do that, we'll be okay. But I also think it's interesting that for whatever reason, you know, we have these explanations made available to us.
Yeah.
And you know, that's just not the case. I mean, you know, you might think, oh, well, maybe it's taught in secret or whatever. But if you read, you know, you can read this great big thick book on Neem Karoli Baba, you know, and he's a great saint and he lifts people up that are in his presence and people talk and tremendous devotion. No explanations along these lines.
No.
And you know, I'm not an expert on all the saints, but from what I've seen, this is the only place, you know. They asked Papa about this and he said, I don't know. Too busy going to God.
Right.
I don't know.
St. John of the Cross does describe a lot in his book about the process of realization.
It's
the dark night of the soul.
I'm sure it's out there. It's just very unique for us to have it explained so clearly, so succinctly, in so much detail. And not just the experience itself, but what the meaning of the experience.
And the connection to the scriptures, which other people haven't mentioned to my knowledge.
Right.
I wonder if that was available to Christ. Because although we know Christ didn't live as the Bible is written, most likely, but that great master, I wonder if that teaching was given to those who were near him.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it may have been more than one, too. It's possible.
Yeah.
It may have been a series of them bringing the Bible forward. By the way, I think we kind of think, well, we have to teach the Christians how to think correctly about this. In a way, I think there's a tremendous, this is what Mother came for, but it is recognition that they've kept the book fairly intact, that there is a story there, that if you know the higher teachings within it, it's actually a very, very high teaching. So in a way, it supports the Christian. They wouldn't accept it. The Orthodox Christians wouldn't accept this. We all know that. But there is the future. The mother is talking about those, the Western, to be respectful of Christianity. You know, it's so easy to go over to India and get a Christian, we talked about this last time, a spiritual name and just leave all of the Jewish and the Christian world alone, and in many Islamic people too, just leave all of that world alone. And, there really is something there, and we have to have respect for it. And so it can be seen both ways. It can be seen as a criticism, but it can also be seen as something that's going to really glorify what the higher teachings are and to keep the mind focused, to bring about a golden age that Mother always talks about.
To peel away those layers that it's hidden.
Right. It's just a misunderstanding. This, I always put it down to the idea that God would love you is more than you can possibly imagine. But if you don't love him back, or you don't play, you know, you don't play the game right, you don't do what you're supposed to do, he will send you to hell. That's just simply not love. And it's not, it's so disorienting to people. It's so discombobulating that the Christian really can't make progress with that. With that particular belief intact in place. I've always thought, you know, reincarnation is more important, but I now I'm more, and it is, it's really releasing. It really releases you, relieves you of a lot of burden. But the idea that God punishes in that way, that, and there's a one-time chance. We got a deal for you. And if you don't take it today, these are salesmen. These are flim-flam. Type of thing. This is what con men do, and I'm sorry to, you know, put it on that to the Christians, because I respect them so much, and they are trying the best, but they're trying, they're focusing too much on the book.
Well, is this heaven and hell just perfect for a mentality of duality?
Yeah.
I mean, if your consciousness is here in the plane of duality, Doesn't that teaching just make perfect sense?
Yeah.
When I bring it to that higher use, though, when you think about as we're coming out of the mammal consciousness into the human consciousness, and we need to be molded into beings that can evolve into higher beings. Those kinds of right and wrong, black and white punishment, like you would train a mammal, is useful to the lower centers and keeping us focusing upward so that we don't slip back into those.
A whip in a chair.
Yeah. I mean, really. Really. It helps us pull ourselves into that will and righteousness and love, instead of just falling back into hedonism, you know, the two lower chakras.
Right, right.
You know, Larry, in one sense, the concept of heaven and hell is correct. It's just that,
right,
for a hellish state of consciousness, God doesn't put us there, right? We put ourselves there.
Yeah, to a great extent, but also
the examples of that, you know,
the idea that we can
all around us.
That there's just only one hell, and you're going to be, you know, with sulfur smell the whole time, and there's one heaven, except for the Mormons having their own portion of the heaven, and those kind of jokes. But really, there is just, it's a very dual type notion. It is, you either make it or you don't. If you don't make it, you're in hell, and it's identical to everybody else's, and it's forever. These are just really, really so inhuman.
I like David's question. Was it heaven for the 72 virgins?
No, exactly. Well, and we bring so much of our physical consciousness into our ideas about the higher planes. Yeah.
It certainly feels like eternity when you're stuck
in that space. Yeah. This is Kala. This is time.
Yeah.
Time is a tough master. Really can be tough. Struggling through it.
Does this mean that I can fire my therapist and go off my medication?
David always says, take your meds. Heard him say it more than once.
Sorry, I just had to say that.
There's that aspect of, well, Larry says, I meditate better when I have my coffee, too. Things that allow us the space to do what we need to do to go higher. And that's always the measure.
The other thing is to take every opportunity. I always think God told me years ago, do what you can when you can.
Yeah.
In other words, the idea that we put these impossible requirements on ourselves that makes us unable to do anything. It locks us in. At any moment, you can do I mean, I do mostly you know, Om Shri Ram, and then I say mother's name. I mean, that's just instinctive to me as I walk. But the main thing is that you do whatever you can. And because your mind is on God, and you think, well, what can I do? Oh, I'm not living. You cannot let that drive you each day. We have to be able to get beyond it, and we have to do something. This minute, every little tiny thing helps. It really does.
Perfect is the enemy of the good.
That's another way of saying it. Do what you can when you can, every possible time, just whatever it can be. I'll give you an example of that thinking too. We all instinctively, and I've heard Mother do this too, so it's just a expression that we do in the West. Oh, I see everyone's already started to eat. Let's say grace, because I would like to present it in a fashion that if anybody decides to say the prayer at any time during the meal, everyone says, oh, what a good idea. Rather than that negative side of that that says, oh, we should have said prayer. No, I don't know of any rules like that. I think prayer is all the time, and we shouldn't try to make this so that we also make people feel bad in that way, especially the person who owns the host or anything like that. It is simply, oh, by the way, could we say grace? That's perfectly okay, and no discussion.
You're right. I mean, people never seem to object.
No, that's right.
It just seems like they're honored, you know? I mean, even if they're not particularly religious, they go, oh, gosh, you know, somebody cares enough to sanctify this meal, you know, in their way.
Isn't David used to say, oh, bless this food that we're already eating? I remember him saying that more than once.
Oh, yeah, for sure. My mother, too. So, yeah. It's not criticism of them, but it is. It is an example of do what you can when you can. It is an example of just to let that go, let everything go that's negative, that takes you away from thinking you should do prayer. So, and what is prayer for? We need to keep it in a more positive fashion.
Especially I like the idea, too, that time is only made for, so everything doesn't happen at once, because everything really is happening at once. So it really doesn't matter when you say it.
it's such a delusion, isn't that? There's a lot of they say the space is so that everything doesn't happen all in the same place, and time is something was invented so that everything doesn't happen all at once. There's a lot of, it really brings you kind of front and center to the problem, what they do. Yeah, it's all on one level, it's all happening right now. There's no such thing as time. Mm-hmm. And then we all kind of have the experience that we've been fooled into this bodily existence where we think time drives us. But we have to remember that time is one of the highest principles. It's part of the causal plane, too. It's not just on this physical plane. It plays out differently here, but it is, even at the causal plane, it's dictated by space and time. That's where it's created above the effect. Because of space and time, that's the nest from which we live in that creates the three bodily jars. It's interesting that Sri Yukteswar, though, also did a book about connecting the Western teachings, the Christian and Jewish teachings with the
holy science.
With the holy science, but what's the shastras, isn't it?
Oh,
he picks and chooses certain shastras to show the connection. So that desire to connect, you know, East and West is manifested in him, and then he was chosen as the one to train Master, and Master came here, and Master became, you know, a mole in this world. He became knowledgeable, and he knew all the secrets of the West intimately. He knew how to write that beautiful book. He knew how to talk to Westerners so beautifully. And then Mother comes along and does another part of that thread that is coming through from Babaji and from the Christ.
You know what I appreciated about Mother is how she was so beautiful. She had her hair done. She put on makeup. She was so attractive, you know, so magnetic, so compelling. I was walking with her once through the Bon, and she told me she'd had three marriage proposals in the last 3 months, all by men that were, you know, 20 yeah. years younger than her or whatever. And I just thought that was so great, you know, because she was so full of life. You know, there wasn't any piousness or, you know,
that picture here of mother is so, she is so beautiful. It's just,
she is the most beautiful there, world. Yeah. She was really something.
What tense do you want to use, Peter?
What's that?
What tense do you want to use when you say what mother is? It is so. That was.
You know, I remember when I first met her, my very first meeting, I was 19, and in the conversation, and it's relevant to this teaching here, she said, she's very intense, you know, I mean, she was really intense, and she said, don't you understand? We're not talking about, you know, an actual man. I mean, she said, this is symbolic, you know. She really wanted to make that point that it wasn't an actual man that lived 2,000 years ago. And apparently I wasn't, acknowledging that enough, you know, with my eyes or my expression or something, because she just really, you know, said, don't you understand that this is not a historic figure. This is not a man that lived 2,000 years ago. You know, this is what happens within you, you know.
That's how she planted the memory in you of that part of the conversation.
Well, she did that. She was, you know, you kind of pay attention and remember things to the extent that of the other person's intensity. Right. You know, I mean, you'll notice that with yourself if somebody ever gets mad at you. You know, oh boy, they were really upset. You know, you remember that. And that's the way it was with her, with that idea. And that was the very first meeting. She really wanted to make that point strongly.
It's a really interesting story. Yeah, very interesting.
And that's exactly what we're talking about here with this mystical crucifixion. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Charmy, you have to unmute. There
no,
you go.
No, I know. I just unmuted. But it's funny. You say she was so intense, but with me, I stuff in my own past, if somebody would have been that intense, I just shut down mentally, gone. I'm gone. She was always so soft and so sweet to me, and never, I mean, never a harsh word in the whole time. One time she said, well, Charmy, that kind of disappointed me. And oh my gosh, I just about melted, you know, to the floor. And I'm just like, oh, but that's the worst she ever said to me. But that.
It's all different, right? Depending on.
Exactly. So it doesn't have to always be intense. It's whatever the person needs.
Depending on how tough the leather is, right?
Yeah, mine was not. I had paper thin at the time. Now I'm a little tougher. Harder to get through.
I think your point, though, too, Peter, was just that concept that she was giving you of the symbology of the Christ, and yet I really loved how she talks about, you know, in the book and when we heard her talking about that crucifixion of your own Christ, and that Christ becomes so real. You know, he's not just a symbol. He's that self, our own Christ, our own self. Yeah. And then talking about how when Christ is nailed to the cross, and that Christ and that you're the one who's crucified that self. And so it becomes very, very real and very almost personified in that respect too. So it's symbolic. It's historic. He's symbolic. He's historical. He's your own self. It's all of the piece, isn't it? You know?
Larry, can you talk a little bit about, I get a bit confused about the causal and the astral. I know one of them is sort of the idea body, the mental, is it?
Right, that's right. Yeah, the astral body is basically, astral realm is peopled with people who look like us, but a 25-year-old version of us is the way Sri Yukteswar explained it. Whereas the causal plane, though it has these five senses, the notion of five senses, the equivalent there, because the astral plane does too. We always explain this is everything here wouldn't exist if it didn't already exist above. So the physical body is a manifestation. It is manifesting a small piece of the astral plane, of the astral world, because of just the energetic requirements and focus it takes. The causal plane is more of floating around. You know, my own experience with the causal plane bumping up against it is that the notion of physical reality, like a world to stand on and to go around and to see the sky, is just not there. It is a floating, bright lights. So I don't, you know, in listening to other people describe it, it doesn't comport with my own experience. And my experience is not very much, but I've bumped into it. I've come into it, and it is so much more complex and subtle than this realm that we only can think of the astral plane by imagining it being a lighter and easier physical plane. And even then, the biggest difference there is that relaxation of the tension that we constantly live with here, the constant hammering for attention from every element all around us, our body, our family, our friends, the earth itself, the city, all of these things are not just lesser or fewer. But instead, the astral world is where we really can, we see that which creates the physical world, and the physical world doesn't seem so daunting. In fact, the physical world is seen as just, well, what's the big deal? It's not, you don't live there very long anyway. And you're just there for a flash in the pan.
It's your once a week workout.
It's your traumatized, it's maybe traumatizing, but you'll get over it. And then the analogy plays out to the causal plane, that it is more realm of projecting and more the realm of imagining things and living in a world where the higher intellect is working continuously, easily, effortlessly, creating worlds. It's often described as that which creates all the universes, all the myriad island universes Master talks about. So the causal plane is often seen as where the seraphim and the cherubim, if you read the Christian teachings, they imagine that there's a court, God holds court, and he has a ring around him of the seraphim. This is Catholic kind of stuff, so many other people believe this because of the big interest in angels too. And angels have been thought about for a long, long time, way before Christ, the Christian era. And then around that is the cherubim, and they're the people who go out and do work. If there's anything needed to be done in the physical plane, they can move into both realms. They live in both realms. And then there's all of the other things around that. But the highest plane is the seraphim saying, holy, holy, holy. It sounds boring, doesn't it? It sounds, what within the world would that be? But it's the lifeblood of this existence. It's that which creates everything from which
it
creates.
It doesn't sound boring to me, Larry. It doesn't sound boring to me.
Nor myself at the moment, me either.
I'll take it. Thanks very much.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you to talk a little bit about the last mile, because it's quite a journey.
Yeah.
And
part of you is impatient, in my case, very impatient, and part of me believes Mother when she says, accept everything, know that everything every day is for your highest good, and love yourself. So it's difficult. So could you talk a little about the last mile?
Going based on Mother's teachings, what she mostly tried to steer us to focus on with the last mile is that you can fall. And that to get to the highest place from which you cannot fall is the goal. We will have a wasted lifetime, or it will seem that way, if we don't do the best we can in this lifetime. So the notion that you could get up all the way, nearly all the way there, and then fall from that state of grace is something that she's mostly warning. She didn't make a big deal about it, but she did show that, or did teach that the state of Sahaja Samadhi is that place from which you cannot fall. And Master talked about it, excuse me, as a param mukta, is what he called that state. It's being established in nirvikalpa samadhi. And again, these things are just unknowable in a sense. They're just unexplainable. So it's funny that mostly, as you mentioned, as you asked that question about or used that term, last mile, what comes to me is the warnings that Mother has. She doesn't scare you. She just says, beware. It's very, very difficult. And it's difficult in ways that she couldn't explain to us. It's the subtlety of existence. It really all comes down to existence itself. Sat. Sat, chit, ananda. Chit is consciousness. Ananda is that which builds the world with the consciousness directing it. The existence pre-exists all of that, and that's the sat. And that getting through the last mile is to break the final body, which is the causal body, is to break outside of that, to leave that, and still be able to come back into it. The salt doll is really a beautiful analogy, because the salt doll goes into the ocean. That's the way Ramakrishna described the state that he attained, and that there's an aspect of himself, he was saying, it's just like being completely dissolved, and there's certainly no worries. But I love Mother's explanation that she was a salt doll put back together by the ocean. But to get beyond the causal body.
I have to finish that, Larry. What does Mother say about why she was put back together?
Go ahead.
I'm trying to remember it.
She said something to the effect that to say that life is God, and that to tell all people everywhere that God is life and life is God.
So she could testify.
And that's her testimony. Yeah.
So Larry, you mentioned the Mother's warning. Mm-hmm. And right. Was that beware of wasting another incarnation?
Well, I mean, it's funny. Yeah, that is kind of what she says, yes, to be honest. But she's mostly trying to give us steering advice. She's trying to give us guidance. She's trying to show, don't take a lower state thinking it's the higher state. Test each spirit. Be very careful with that last bit. Make sure you really are there. Be careful. More that way, from my understanding and what she said, you know, or taught me, or what stuck with me.
Because the ego is so tricky, you know, it's very, very tricky, and yeah, it's like you're living in two different places, because the ego is saying you're doing great, you know, like Ramnam is.
Yeah.
Yeah, like Ramnam is playing, you know, you think of God lots, blah, blah, blah. But the other part is how do you explain it? The truth. The truth.
I love Larry's admonishment, which is do what you can when you can. And we know We know that when we're not doing that, and that's that niggling that you're feeling. I'm doing this and this and this, but we're not doing what we can when we can.
And we have another clue. We have another clue in the bliss that spiritual work tells us to follow the bliss. People make fun of Joseph Campbell for saying that, but it's so true. We need to be able to follow the bliss, but we do have to understand what bliss is too. It's not, it's not pleasure. It has, and it's not ecstasy, but it has elements of that. It's associated with all of those.
Larry, I love that you shared that, that the seraphim are saying holy, 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 and their words so that our human mind can make sense of it, but just the sense felt within just when you shared that was that is the basis of existence.
It is. You can feel it, can't you? You can feel
it. Just nothing would exist without that. That's just beautiful.
You know, Mother always, she told stories and she did so many things as she gave her talk, but I've been listening carefully now in these last couple of years, and when she, as she talks, she always, she can talk very loudly and forcefully throughout much of the talk, but she always brought us back to just loving God at the end of every single talk, and she did it so many different ways, and that's because it was a manifestation of her state, the state she was, that she lived in and lives in. Jill.
Larry, could you talk about Father? Because he's always been a mystery to me, her husband.
Mother told me not to talk about him.
Oh, did she?
Yeah.
Okay. I just wondered, like, what...
It was a pretty rough... It's probably the harshest thing she's ever said to me.
Yeah. Herlin talked about him a little bit to me.
Yeah, he knew him well. I never met him.
Okay. Hmm. All right, so... No news about, like, was he a queer ban or anything like that? You can't tell me.
Oh, yes. He was a minister. He was ordained by a master.
Okay.
He was something special. He really was.
Yeah.
He came in at a very important time in Mother's life.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So.
I don't know why she said that to me, and I don't know why she did it in the way that she did it so harshly. And she, like Charmy, I agree with you. She never was too harsh on to me at all. So, but except for that time, and maybe one other time.
Maybe she's really protective of him.
I think she doesn't want the focus. First of all, it is difficult to know what to do with your spouse for Mother. I'm sure, especially being a man, and he was a. You know, major. I just read something about him in what Mother, some of Mother's stuff. He was a, maybe Kate remembers better, but he was a general manager. He was way up in the phone company business. Mm-hmm. So, so it must have been difficult to be, you know, married to someone like Mother. And she was giving a, you know, she knew Yogananda much longer than he did and was given the title Yogacharya. She was identified as the main teacher.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think she just, I don't know, but to not spend a lot of time on that and not not to worry about what role he played.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, he was really there for her in at Anandashram.
Yeah, he really was.
Okay, thanks.
Well, this baptism of blood is, I think, one of the most difficult things to understand with Mother. And the marriage at Cana and the notion that turning the water into wine, and the sound of the dripping and the water being poured in to a jug is the sound that she experienced. One thing I'm pretty sure that the story of Jesus being there at the wedding of Cana. I've read elsewhere too that a lot of people think that Jesus was his own wedding. That's the better explanation. This is mostly, these are scholars talking about. If you read the, you know, the original Aramaic and the Hebrew, there seems to be more like he's describing. It'd be more likely that he would be talking about his own wedding and not somebody else's wedding who's not even identified. But it was a key place. It was a key point where, what? He enters the field. He comes to his teachings, to his miraculous world. He comes out of the wilderness or wherever he was between the missing 18 years. In the story, that wedding was his own, most likely. But that's the necessary thing he needed to have. Now, in the allegorical story, what does that mean? It means the person has truly either continuously aware of the missing part. We are all bifurcated by duality and more pronounced in that sense in the physical realm. So we feel this dual nature. It has all kinds of, the whole idea of having a spouse that is your twin. What's the word I'm looking for?
Soulmate.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So having a soulmate, all of those kinds of things. And we do feel that way with spouses. You know, we know people like this. We have some experience ourselves. They do play that role. But the soulmate is that part of you, of yourself, that is not manifest. And so since we're male or female, one or the other, we tend to what's missing from us is we imagine the other gender. So that's to show that he was ready to make the next step up, to move into the realm and to do the work he was chosen to do, he was given to do. So from the soul's point of view, that means you are now ready to enter the spiritual path. It's not your guru that you're meeting, your soulmate. It's not your guru. It's a place that you stand, from which you stand. And it's not to do with a real spouse. It's got to do with what that spouse might represent in yourself. And they're integrating that with you, and then you're ready to start the final path, really, because in Jesus' story, he'd already gone through Herod being killed and coming back into Nazareth and all of that stuff, and meeting John the Baptist, many wonderful things. And then at that point, though, this was the main event when he got married, or whatever that wedding feast. So what does this mean with the baptism of blood? Does that mean that that's the initiatory experience? That you have to go through that? The heart pumps blood. And the heart center is always associated with Jesus being crucified on a cross. It gets to be complicated, and I'm sorry to complicate it, because Golgotha means the hill of the skull, and that means the final crucifixion, the final event. But
the heart center is the crucifixion from going from the physical and above. That's the higher beginning, the higher center. Yeah.
Thank you. It's the first of the divine centers of entering divine.
Cross that center line.
So in Mother says that Jesus fell three times. Those are reflecting. That's reflecting. Or is it twice? I forget. Anyway, he reflects that each of the falls is the attaining the next chakra level. And then the final one is in the skull. That's the seventh chakra. But the depiction is Jesus being crucified on a cross. The cross clearly means the arms and at the heart center, the Gordian knot, that whole approach. So it's not a perfect analogy. It's not a perfect allegory. It's, that can teach every little detail. I think when you go through each crucifixion, that you revisit what you've done before and you see the similarities of. It's good for this time. Mm-hmm. We'll start on the next chapter next week. I guess for now, we're going to do them every week until people complain or can't make it. Mm-hmm. Please pray with me. Oh, Heavenly Father.
Oh, Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
I feel the wonder and the beauty.
Of thy glorious presence.
Of thy glorious presence.
In every part of my being.
In every part of my being.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
My heart is bursting with my love for thee.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet.
I kneel in adoration at thy feet.
And surrender myself to thee.
And surrender myself to thee.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
I feel the power of thy perfection.
Surging in every cell of my body.
Surging in every cell of my body.
My mind and my intelligence.
My mind and my intelligence.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
Are radiant with thy healing light.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
My soul is filled with the ecstasy and bliss.
Of my communion with thee.
Of my communion with thee.
I and my Father are one.
I and my Father are one.
Blessed Spirit, I am.
Blessed Spirit, I am.
Oh. Oh. Peace.
Peace.
Bliss.
Bliss. Amen.